The purpose of this recording is to provide some practical help for students of ancient Greek, both elementary and advanced, who wish to learn to pronounce the language in approximately the way it was pronounced in the classical period of the 5th and 4th centuries BC in Athens. Two questions can be raised at once. First, how can we know how ancient Greek was actually pronounced? Second, why is it important to take the time to learn the pronunciation of a language which today nobody speaks? Before I attempt to answer these questions, perhaps I might say a word about the linguistic background of the Greek language. Ancient Greek is a member of the Indo-European family of languages, a family which includes Sanskrit, the Slavic languages, the Germanic languages, including English, and the Italic languages, including Latin and its descendants, the Romance languages. It is only natural, then, that ancient Greek shares certain features of vocabulary, of grammar, and of pronunciation with modern languages such as English, French, German, and Italian. Ancient Greek is, so to speak, a linguistic relative of our own English language. Actually, ancient Greek itself was not a simple monolithic structure. It had variations which depended upon chronology and geography. For example, the literary language of the classical 5th century BC clearly differed in certain respects from the language of the Homeric poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, which were probably composed in the 8th century BC, though there is little tangible evidence concerning the pronunciation of this pre-classical Greek. In turn, classical Greek of the 5th and 4th centuries BC differed considerably from the Byzantine Greek of the Middle Ages and from modern Greek, which is actually quite close to Byzantine Greek in pronunciation. In this case, we do have much evidence to document the linguistic changes, including that of the pronunciation. These chronological changes in the Greek language are in no way unique or surprising. Every language of which we have historical information, including our own English, has undergone major changes in structure and pronunciation through the centuries. What indeed may seem surprising is that the Greek language changed less over a span of approximately 3,000 years than other languages changed over a much smaller span of time. In addition to chronological variations in ancient Greek, we have geographical variations. The early Greeks, or Proto-Greeks, coming from the north in successive waves of immigration during the 3rd and 2nd millennia BC, ultimately settled in various sections of the Balkan Peninsula, on the islands of the Aegean Sea, and on the coast of Asia Minor. These various segments of the Greek people, once settled, remained in relative isolation from one another, which linguistically resulted in the development of several distinct dialects, a phenomenon well known in the United States, in England, France, Germany, Italy, and in many other countries. In the case of ancient Greek, these dialectical variations are clearly reflected in the literature. Sappho, for example, composes her lyric poetry in the Aeolic dialect. The historian Herodotus writes in the Ionic dialect. The pastoral poet Theocritus composes his works in the Doric dialect, while Plato writes his philosophy in the Attic dialect. Despite these variations of chronology and geography, in our study of the pronunciation of ancient Greek, we shall concentrate, as I said at the beginning, on the pronunciation of Attic Greek of the 5th and 4th centuries BC. Admittedly, this is a compromise in an attempt to restore a completely authentic sound to the works of Greek literature. But it is a compromise which has both practical and theoretical justifications. Our strongest and clearest evidence on ancient Greek pronunciation is for Attic Greek of the classical period. Our evidence for preclassical pronunciations and for dialectical pronunciations is simply too scanty to form a solid reconstruction. Then again, we must remember that the bulk of extant ancient Greek literature was composed in Athens during the 5th and 4th centuries BC in the Attic dialect and pronunciation. We can also assume as quite probable that when pre-classical authors such as Homer, Hesiod, and the lyric poets were later recited in classical Athens, they too were recited with the contemporary Attic pronunciation, just as Shakespeare today is performed with the contemporary English pronunciation and not with the original Elizabethan pronunciation. Our focus, then, in the pronunciation of ancient Greek will be on Attic Greek of the 5th and 4th centuries B.C. Let us return now to our two basic questions. First, how can we know today how ancient Greek was actually pronounced? After all, Sophocles and Plato did not use Sony tape recorders, as perhaps you are at this very moment. True enough. But modern linguists have many clear sources of information concerning the pronunciation of ancient Greek. First of all, we have the testimony of ancient Greek grammarians and other writers who frequently give a precise description concerning specific aspects of pronunciation. For example, the grammarian Dionysius of Thrace, speaking about the musical pitch accents in ancient Greek, says, "Accent is a modification of the musical voice. By raising the pitch in the acute accent, by leveling the pitch in the grave accent, and by bending the pitch in the circumflex accent." In our discussion of the pitch accents, we shall try to apply this information given by Dionysius. Secondly, we have in the literary works themselves examples of puns and other forms of wordplay, as well as many cases of onomatopoeia, the imitation of natural sounds. And so when Aristophanes will have a sheep bleat with a word which he spelled beta eta, while the modern Greek pronunciation would have the sheep say vi, vi, the ancient pronunciation is ba, ba. Why, even the modern Greek sheep which I heard in Greece still say ba. Another important source of information concerning pronunciation comes from the representation or the transliteration of ancient Greek into other ancient languages. For example, the Romans who went to Athens to study philosophy had to introduce the word philosophy into the Latin language because Latin had no word of equivalent meaning. But when the Romans came to write in the Latin alphabet the Greek word, which is now generally pronounced philosophia, they represented the first Greek letter phi not by the modern sound of F, but by a P followed by their letter for an aspirate sound, H, the combination being something like the sound of PH in the English word uphill, P. If the sound of the letter phi which they heard had been the fricative, F, the Romans would have used their own letter F to represent the Greek letter. But instead, they use the aspirated P, P. Here we have simple and clear proof that the word philosophy was pronounced in ancient Greek, philosophia. We have numerous other sources of information concerning the pronunciation of ancient Greek, which there is not sufficient time to discuss now. We can, however, say that linguists today all over the world, except paradoxically in Greece, on the basis of absolutely clear and convincing evidence, are in general agreement about how Attic Greek of the 5th and 4th centuries was pronounced. Our second basic question was, why is it important to take the time to learn the correct pronunciation of a language which today nobody speaks? The answer to this question involves the very nature of ancient Greek literature. For full details on this question, I recommend your reading the wise and eloquent book of W.B. Stanford entitled The Sound of Greek. This recording, I should say, has been greatly inspired by the pioneering work of Professor Stanford. Let me simply state here that none, absolutely none, of the works of ancient Greek literature was intended for individual and silent book reading in the modern manner. At the time when ancient Greek literature was composed, relatively few people had any books at all, since a book had to be copied by hand onto a papyrus or a parchment roll, a long and expensive process. As a matter of fact, it is quite possible, if not probable, that Homer, the first of the Greek authors who has come down to us, did not even know how to read or write. But whether or not it be true that Homer was illiterate, What is certain is that he and the other ancient Greek authors composed their works for an oral and collective performance. In other words, for a public recital. The process of literary communication consisted of the flow of sound from the lips of the author to the ears of his assembled audience without the intermediary of the written or the printed word. And even in those relatively rare cases where someone did own a book of literature, the owner of the book would always read the work to himself out loud. It was only many hundreds of years later, well into the Christian era, that our practice of silent reading began. In ancient Greek literature, then, the element of sound is of central importance. Obviously, then, a correct pronunciation of the ancient Greek is crucial to a full and valid literary experience. An incorrect pronunciation will presumably vitiate, or at least distort, this experience. You know, there is a famous sonnet of Shakespeare which begins, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds," and so on. Imagine the case of a Frenchman who declares his passionate admiration for the sonnets of Shakespeare, particularly the one, he says, which begins, "Let me not to the mariage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds." I think you would agree with me that our Frenchman, despite his understanding of the meaning and of the sentiments of the verse, is losing an essential element of Shakespeare's poetry by his producing and hearing the wrong music. But in order not to be unfair to any Frenchman or Francophile who may be listening, just imagine the case of the American, who declares his passionate admiration for the poems of Paul Verlaine, particularly that one, he says, which begins, "Il pleure dans mon cour, comme il pleut sur la ville." Well, it seems to me that we do something quite similar with Homer and the other ancient Greek authors when we read their works with the modern Greek or with the traditional Erasmian pronunciation. Perhaps a specific illustration will make this point clear. Let's listen to the first 7 lines of the Iliad read with 3 different pronunciations: the modern Greek pronunciation, the Erasmian pronunciation, and finally, the restored ancient pronunciation. It might be helpful to listen to this section while looking at the Greek text of Homer, which is printed in the booklet accompanying this recording, although I think the principal differences in sound will be readily apparent to the ears alone. The first rendition of Homer, which you will hear, will be done with the modern Greek pronunciation. You will notice, in the modern Greek pronunciation, the phenomenon called iotacism, the fact that many different vowels and diphthongs, such as eta, epsilon iota, upsilon, and omicron iota, are all pronounced e, like the pronunciation of iota. Furthermore, in the modern Greek pronunciation, the diphthong alpha upsilon is pronounced af, the diphthong epsilon upsilon is pronounced f.
Μήνυν άιδε θεά, πηλιάδε ο αχιλίος ουλωμένην, ή μυρί αχαιείς άλγε έθηκεν, πολλάς διφθήμους ψυχάς άιδη προείαψεν ηρώων, αυτούς δε ελώρια τέφχε κίνεσιν ιονίσιτε δέτα. Διός δε ετελείε το βουλί, εξούδι τα πρώτα διαστήτην ερίσαντε ατρεΐδιστε άναξ ανδρών και δίος αχιλλεύς.
The second rendition will be in the so-called Erasmian pronunciation, the pronunciation which is still generally taught in the United States and in Europe. Erasmus, the great humanistic scholar of the Renaissance, objected to the practice of ioticism in the pronunciation of ancient Greek. He also objected to the pronunciation of the diphthong alpha upsilon as af, as opposed to au, and of epsilon upsilon as f, as opposed to eu. And he was, of course, linguistically correct. However, as you will hear, in the Erasmian pronunciation, the letters phi, chi, and theta are incorrectly pronounced as the fricatives th, ch, th. While no attempt is made to use the musical pitch accents or the rhythmic patterns based upon syllabic quantity.
Μένε να είδε θεά πελέα δω αχιλέως, ούλο μενέν χεμύρια χαϊόες αλγεθέκεν, πόλας διφθυμούς ψυχάς αιδί προϊάψεν, πέρο ον αυτούς δε λόρια τεύχε κυνέσιν, οι ανοίσιτε δαίτα, διόστε τελέτε βούλε, Εξ ουδέτα πρώτα διάστε σέν ρισάντε, ατρεϊδές τε ανάξανδρόν, καί δίος αχίλεος.
The third rendition will use the restored ancient pronunciation. Here the attempt is made to give to the various vowels and consonants their correct values, to make use of the musical pitch accents, and to employ rhythmic patterns based upon syllabic quantity rather than upon syllabic stress. The sound of the archaic letter digamma, w, has occasionally been restored for reasons of euphony, that is, to avoid hiatus.
Man in a wedetea, palaiadio achilleos. Ulaminan hemiria caios alge et hake, polaus diptimus psychas avidi proiapsin, eroon autus de gloria teuce cinesin, oion oisite daita dios de teleia tabula, Εξ ούδε τα πρώτα διαστέτεν ρισάντε, ατρεϊδές τεύαν αξανδρόν, καί δίος αχίλλεος.
Although I do not have the illusion that the use of the restored ancient pronunciation will permit me or anyone today to achieve precisely the pronunciation and intonation that Homer, Euripides, Plato, and Demosthenes gave to their works, we can achieve a good approximation. Again, one might ask, why bother at all? My answer is that, far more important, even than the question of historical accuracy and of honestly making the best of our knowledge, is the question of aesthetic truth. Just as archaeologists and art historians carefully gather together and study the broken pieces of marble at the foot of the Parthenon, and then restore as much as knowledge permits, in order to give us as clear an image as possible of the temple's original beauty, so do linguists and literary scholars carefully gather evidence and restore as much as possible of the authentic pronunciation of ancient Greek, for a reason which is as simple as it is profound. Since all of the ancient Greek authors created their works in the framework of a flow of sound from author to listener, it is clear that the closer we can come to hearing the authentic sound of the ancient Greek, the closer we will come to perceiving the original beauty and the aesthetic essence of the Greek literary creation. And now to the theory and the practice of the pronunciation of ancient Greek. In the next part of this recording, I shall deal with the three principal components of this pronunciation: the sound of the vowels and the consonants, the musical pitch accents, and the poetic rhythms. My aim here will not be to give an exhaustive treatment, but simply to provide a solid introduction to the subject. For this reason, some points of fine detail will be omitted from my presentation. For those who would wish to have a clear and fully detailed linguistic explanation of this material, I recommend the excellent book of W. S. Allen, entitled Volksgraika, spelled V-O-X-G-R-A-E-C-A, and subtitled A Guide to the Pronunciation of Classical Greek. This recording is highly indebted to Professor Allen's work for many points of linguistic clarification. In our treatment of the sound of the vowels and the consonants in ancient Greek, of the musical pitch accents, and of the poetic rhythms, a most useful concept to keep in mind is that of distinctions in sound. Every language has its own particular pattern of distinctions in sound, some of which may also exist in other languages, some may not. In English, for example, we do have a clear distinction between the initial consonants of the two words pin and bin. The initial consonant of the first word, pin, we call an unvoiced stop. The initial consonant of the second, bin, a voiced stop. Linguists refer to this phenomenon as a phonemic distinction between the two consonants, a phoneme being defined as a minimum unit of distinctive sound feature. Native speakers of English usually have no difficulty in hearing and producing distinctive P's and B's, since they have grown up in a linguistic environment in which this phonemic distinction is an integral part of the language. Ancient Greek, however, had a somewhat different pattern of phonemic distinctions. For example, in addition to having the same phonemic distinction between P and B as that in English, ancient Greek, as we shall soon see in detail, also had a phonemic distinction between an aspirated P, P, and an unaspirated P, pa. What we must do in learning to pronounce any foreign language correctly is first to become mentally aware of those phonemic distinctions in the foreign language which do not exist in our own native language, then to sensitize our ears to detect these new phonemic distinctions when pronounced by others, and finally, to try to reproduce these phonemic distinctions ourselves when pronouncing the foreign language. What I have just said about phonemic distinctions as applied to certain sounds in ancient Greek is, I imagine, quite clear to anyone who has studied a modern foreign language, for the principles are precisely the same. However, the concept of distinctions in sound will be applied to two elements of ancient Greek which are not found in the commonly studied modern foreign languages, the musical pitch accents and the poetic rhythms based upon syllabic quantity. As we shall see, in the case of the pitch accents, it is not the specific pitch of the accented syllable which is important. What counts is that the listener can hear a clear distinction in pitch between the accented and the unaccented syllables, or occasionally between contrasting pitch movements on the same syllable. Likewise, in the matter of syllabic quantity, there is no absolute length to a syllable which is classified as long, and no absolute time value to a syllable classified as short. All that matters is that the listener be able to hear a clear distinction in quantity or duration between long and short syllables. In all of these aspects of the pronunciation of ancient Greek, then, it is the discernible distinction of sounds which is of primary importance. I think it would be helpful in our treatment of the pronunciation of ancient Greek vowels and consonants to proceed from the relatively known to the relatively unknown. As I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, ancient Greek, as a linguistic relative of English, has many sounds which have their close counterpart in modern English. Let's begin then with a quick review of those letters and sounds of ancient Greek which have close equivalents to sounds represented by letters of the modern English alphabet. Please feel free at any time during the phonetic discussions which follow to stop the recording or to replay certain passages in order for you to practice or to review the material which has been presented. The Greek letter beta is pronounced b, as in boy. Gamma is pronounced as a hard g, g, as in get, except when followed by another gamma, or by a kappa, or a chi, or a mu. In such combinations, that is, of double gamma, gamma kappa, gamma chi, and gamma mu, the first element is pronounced ng, like the letters ng in the English word sing. Delta is pronounced d, slightly forward, with the tip of the tongue touching the upper front teeth, like the French dedans. Kappa is pronounced k, without aspiration, as in the word skin. Lambda is pronounced l, as in the word lean. Mu is pronounced m, as in the word me. Nu is pronounced n, as in the word not. Pi is pronounced b, without aspiration, as in the word spin. Sigma is pronounced s, as in the word sand. However, sigma, when followed by a beta, a gamma, a delta, or a mu, is pronounced like a z, z, as in the word cosmetic. Tau is pronounced t, without aspiration, as in the word stop. We come now to three Greek letters which, in effect, represent combinations of two separate consonants and are generally called double consonants. These are the letter zeta, often called zeta, pronounced zd, as the letters sd are pronounced in the English word wisdom, zd. The letter xi, pronounced x, as the letter x is pronounced in the English word tax, x. The letter psi, pronounced ps, as the letters ps are pronounced in the English word taps.